Welcome to Sharkpedia. We're your hosts, Megan
and Imani,
a couple of shark researchers that want to bring the science to you.
We're creating a space to learn all things sharks
and their relatives,
answer your questions,
and learn from the legends in the field.
Get ready to jump in.
Let's dive deep into the world of sharks.
Everyone, I am really excited to have Dr. Haley Dalton today to review her article, Regional Endothermic Traits in Planktivorous Basking Sharks, Seta Hyinus Maximus? How do we think that was? Never said that Latin name out loud before.
Me neither. I don't know.
I am so super excited to have Dr. Dalton on today because I actually saw this paper as a presentation in October of last year at Sharks International. And it was one of my favorite papers. And I was so excited when it finally came out. So I could be like, hey, come talk about it on the podcast. So we are very excited to have you today.
Yeah, thanks for being here, Dr. Dalton.
Thank you for having me. Sorry, the Dr. Dalton thing is still very new.
Yeah.
So whenever I hear it, I'm like,
oh. I know the last time I saw you talk about this, you were not yet Dr. Dalton, so that must have been a change.
No, yeah. I'm enjoying the alliteration that's come along with being Dr. Dalton.
Hooray.
No, thank you very much for having me. I'm excited to chat to you both. So yeah.
Excited. So our summary for this article is the majority of sharks are classified as cold-blooded or ectotherms. Sharks are constantly battling heat loss due to the surrounding water, and to combat this, some fast-swimming apex species are classified as regional endotherms, having uncommon physiological traits such as elevated internal body temperatures, centralized red muscle, and thick-walled hearts. Within the order Lamniformes, housing the only regionally endothermic sharks, you can find the basking shark, which is a large filter-feeding planktivorous species. Previous research has led to the conclusion that basking sharks are ectothermic. To investigate this, Dalton et al. Collected muscle samples and measured internal temperature of basking sharks, finding that they displayed the traits previously stated that would be associated with being a regional endotherm. The research leads to the finding that basking sharks may not be correctly classified as an ectotherm, which was a very surprising find and why I'm so excited to talk about this paper. So before we start, would you please just introduce yourself and broadly speaking what you research and where you're at in your career?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm Hayley. Day to day, I go by Hayley, not Dr. Dalton. And yeah, my PhD is funded by the Irish Research Council and I'm based at Trinity College Dublin in Ireland. And overall, I research anatomy, physiology, behavior, and conservation of large fish in Irish waters.
Very cool. Well, we are very excited to talk about this. This is a really fascinating paper.
Yeah, it blew my mind.
Thank you. Yeah.
It really did.
Good. That's an awesome reaction to have from a paper. So, yeah.
So our first question is, this is the first mussel paper that we've had on the podcast. So could you just briefly say what the difference is between red and white mussel for our listeners who maybe have no clue that there is two different types of mussels found in sharks?
Yeah, sure. So the majority of fish are kind of made up of white and red mussel. So red mussel is more for the aerobic behaviors. So like more, say, if we were running a marathon, so that type of consistent behavior, whereas white mussel is used for explosive anaerobic events. So think kind of white sharks leaping out the water. So that's what that mussel type is used for within shark species. And kind of physiologically speaking, there are differences in terms of fiber size of those different mussel types. So white mussel tends to be a bit bigger. Red mussel is smaller in diameter, and red mussel is densely packed full of mitochondria, which we all know, powerhouse of the cell. We've learned that for an overdraw in our education. And also filled with like hemoglobin and myoglobin. So that red muscle is really for, yeah, generating sustained power.
Amazing. And let's get some, I think, some vocabulary out of the way, because there's definitely some terminology in here that our listeners might not have heard before. So can you describe what a metabolic rate is in layman's terms?
Yeah, sure. So a metabolic rate is basically cells need to undergo different reactions to keep us alive. And it's the reaction rate of those kind of processes, which is the metabolic rate. So I don't know if I can explain that even simpler. Yeah, basically like a time frame that the cells will go through in order to generate energy and heat and then get rid of waste products like lactate. So much like, you know, we do after sport, we're all trying to get rid of the same stuff.
I think that was a great response.
I think arguably I might understand metabolic rate better.
Yeah. I'm going to put that in my pocket for later. Exactly. And then what is warm-blooded or endothermic compared to an ectothermic or cold-blooded fish?
Yeah, so a cold-blooded fish, their body temperature would tend to always want to decline or kind of increase towards whatever ambient is doing. So they can, of course, like try and alter what's going on internally by changing their behavior, but they're always going to be, say, yeah, their internal body temperature is always going to be influenced somewhat by what's going on externally. Whereas with the regionally endothermic fish, they're able to generate body heat, but more importantly, maintain it in certain areas within their body. So whether that's eyes, viscera, muscles, or brain. So they can, yeah, just maintain their body heat in certain tissues.
So cool. Okay, and last vocabulary word that we'll go over before we jump into some other questions is, what is a regional endotherm?
Yeah, so that's what I was meaning just there. So it's keeping different regions of their body warm. Oh. So yeah, sorry. So there's only one species of fish that we know of so far that's capable of whole body endothermy, which is the OPA. So it's a really unusual looking fish, a bit like a sunfish, a colourful sunfish. But that can keep all parts of its body warm, including the heart. So that's a real kind of, yeah, interesting difference between, yeah, whole body endothermy in fish and regional endothermy. So those regional endotherms, which include the sharks, can only keep certain body tissues warm within their body. So not everything.
Oh, that's so interesting. I had to, when you said the OPA and I had to look it up. That is a really strange looking fish.
Yeah, colorful pancake.
Very so. Colorful pancake. I agree. Yeah.
So in the order Lamniformes, which is mentioned in the introduction, and for our listeners, some really cool species that are included in that order are mako sharks and thresher sharks, which are super popular. That's the only order that contains regionally endothermic sharks, and some of those species also just so happen to be the fastest sharks that we know of. Are all sharks in this order regional endotherms?
Yeah, great question. So I don't think we really know. So within that order, I think there's been a lot of assumptions made on whether they're ectotherms or regional endotherms. So we currently don't really know the status of that order, I'd say.
That's one of my favorite responses, honestly, because that just means there's so much more science to have.
yeah, exactly. It's exciting. You know, especially finding, you know, we've got this planktivorous regional endotherm now, so it kind of highlights perhaps there's more investigations to be done.
Science.
This is what we do, right? Yeah, build upon, yeah, knowledge. So
I feel like we kind of danced around this, but most sharks are ectothermic, so why is being an endotherm even advantageous? You mentioned keeping things warm, but what does that do for the organism?
Yeah, I kind of think of this at almost like two different scales. So we've kind of got day-to-day living. So if you're a predator, if you've got a warm brain and eyes, that's better, like if you're hunting down prey, so like chasing after stuff. And, you know, if you're a regional endotherm, you've got a higher metabolic rate, which also means you're producing more and more waste products. And being warmer in certain areas helps you to get rid of those waste products. It also helps increase digestion rates. So there's a lot of kind of shorter term, I guess, benefits to being a regionally endothermic shark. And in the more kind of global kind of scale, being a regional endotherm was thought to either increase your niche, so where you can live. So if you're a regional endotherm, does that allow you to explore different temperatures of water? Or it was thought to increase swim speed and migration distances, which is more kind of what we're seeing from recent research. So one of my colleagues, Dr. Lucy Harding, one of her papers showed that one of the main benefits of being a regional endotherm is an increase in swim speed. And then other research by Watanabe has shown that it also increases migration distances over a shorter amount of time. So it appears the newer research is perhaps saying it's more to do with, yeah, increasing speed.
Yeah, speed. And maybe like in terms of distance, not always like short terms, like sprints, like we think of. Because that's what I think was so surprising to me reading this paper was like, a filter feeder shark could have a similar like body physiology as an apex predator just because they're having to move their body over like such long distances.
Yeah.
And I never really thought about it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I used to do a lot of work on the Isle of Man. So that's an island found between the UK and Ireland. And one of the tags that went out on a basking shark from the research group over there, Manx Basking Shark Watch, they tracked a basking shark from the Isle of Man over to Newfoundland, and it made that journey within about 3 months, which is incredibly fast and more comparable to those regionally endothermic fish. So you're exactly right, those longer kind of migrations.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Sometimes sharks make me feel like I'm lazy. Like, I'm like, they really travel really far, and I, like, don't want to walk to the store.
Be more basking shark. That's it.
So, exactly. So, why did you choose the basking shark specifically? Because if I'm remembering correctly, there's, like, 15 or 16 species within lamniforms. And what was it about the basking shark that you were like, yeah, this giant shark?
This one is speaking to me. With the basking shark research, so I kind of initially just kind of fell into it. Like one of the first ever projects I was involved with was with Manx Basking Shark Watch on the Isle of Man. And I remember while I was there thinking, oh, these seem to be like a lot quicker than I've heard that they are. I've heard that they're really slow and sluggish, and they move a lot like a great white as well, or a white shark. And I originally started off trying to do some research into this, like way back when. And I had an infrared imaging camera that I borrowed off a fire kind of, I can't even remember, like fire service. So I managed to like borrow one of their cameras, and I was recording their fin temperature and nose temperature, so trying to see if they were warmer than the water. That was before I really knew anything about like science, so it was very like just trying to do what I could.
I mean, did it work?
I mean, yeah, without any calibrations, like it did show that the sharks were warmer, and I actually recorded one whilst it was being tagged, and the temperature like shot up. So it seemed to work. But when I went, so I must get back to that data at some point and have like a proper good look. But that's kind of what really piqued my interest. And then fast forward a few years, I started my PhD with Dr. Nicholas Payne at Trinity, and we all know what happened over the recent past few years. So the pandemic hit. And for us PhD students, I was just thinking, oh no, like all of my field work and everything is gone. How am I going to COVID proof my thesis? Which was when I started to revisit these ideas with Nick. And Nick has also been having those ideas as well. So we came like about designing this whole project was really COVID proofing my thesis and getting back to basics and doing kind of literature searches and hoping that we could maybe dissect one at some point. And then that's how the whole project kind of came about.
That's awesome. And like such a like specific thing that only a few of us really know what it feels like to COVID proof your thesis.
Yeah. An odd phrase, but you know.
So you mentioned that you were basically like waiting to for there to be like washed up basking sharks. Could you expand on what are some of the historic challenges to studying basking shark physiology?
Yeah, sure. So, as I mentioned on the Isle of Man, I've been doing basking shark research on and off for about 10 years now. And within those 10 years, I've only like heard of about 3 basking shark strandings within the Isle of Man in the UK and Ireland. So they're incredibly rare to get a stranding, but also a stranding that's fresh enough to be of any use in terms of anatomical or physiological studies. So it is a really rare event. And, you know, these, we only ever see these sharks really for a very small window. So only kind of during the months where they're more coastal, so they tend to be more pelagic, and when the weather's good enough for them to be up at the surface. So in reality, we probably only have about 5 fieldwork days in a year. Like, so,
5? You
know, yeah, it's something between like 5 and 10 days. Like it's really, really, their window is very, very short.
That's so stressful.
Yeah. Definitely. We have to be like, we're on call really for like the whole period where they might turn up, which is April to September. And we just all have to like run and dash to the right place at the right time.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is hard to plan for.
It is. Yeah. Definitely is.
It's kind of like, I feel like this is such an odd segue, but I have a lot of friends who were due to have a baby this October and they have their like grab bag for going to the hospital. And I'm like, I feel like you had a grab bag of basking shark supplies, which is so bizarre.
100%. Yeah. At one point, like my living room was covered in grab bags for basking shark stuff.
That's the best kind of grab bag I've seen.
So our next question was, how hard was it to find these samples? But you basically just answered that. And it sounds like it was very stressful and also very hard. Did you, I probably know the answer to this, but what was your backup plan if you didn't get basking sharks? Like what would you have done with your PhD if this is like all weighing on that?
Ooh. Yeah, great question. What would have been my backup plan? Ooh, I don't know.
Sometimes
that I really
you don't
had
need
one
a plan B. Sometimes it just works.
Yeah. that's it. It kind of this project happened to work, right place, right time. And then subsequently kind of spawned a whole load of other projects. So, I was in the very fortunate position of not having to kind of plan for that backup. But I'm sure it would have come along. So
science. So fun.
Science. Yeah.
And you recorded body and ambient water temperatures. And to do that, you used a new electronic biologging tag package, which I thought was very interesting. Can you tell us what that package included and how you deployed it? Because I feel like what a lot of people think shark tagging is not what you did.
Correct.
So with this new tag package, so tagging of a free swimming basking shark and then leaving the shark alone to do its thing. And then the tag coming out of the shark hours later when none of us was near it. That's all completely new. So we had to come up with a new way to do this with this species. And that involved us designing a new tagging package where we took kind of existing knowledge of how to tag basking sharks. So using a very specific, it's called titanium anchor. So we used a very specific anchor, which goes into the musculature of the shark. And then we also had, as with all these science things, it's a really high-tech window cleaners pole that we used for our actual deployment pole, with a Hawaiian sling to generate that power. And then with the electronic stuff, what we did was we had, we used a low-tech temperature sensor, but we inverted its use to how the manufacturer wanted us to use it. So with that tag, it has a long flexible stalk, and that enabled us to really have more options in terms of our tag design. And then it also had another temperature sensor in the thicker body of this temperature sensor. And we were able to run that flexible stalk alongside an anchor line. And that anchor line was attached to that titanium anchor. And then that anchor line and the titanium anchor were, when it was held in the musculature, that flexible stalk was threaded alongside that. And the anchor line was attached to a buoyancy package, which is being dragged by the shark. It's a very small package, so we try to reduce all impacts and everything to our tagged animals. And within that buoyancy foam contained a satellite tag and a radio tag, so that helped us to find the tag after it had come off the shark. And in the anchor line, we had a timed release. And about 12 hours later, that timed release dissolved and that broke that anchor line. And then the buoyancy package was able to drag out the thin filament of the temperature sensor. And then the whole thing came off the shark. And then hours later, we went to go find it. So that's how we designed it. It's really hard as well to explain that without visuals, but hopefully, hopefully you understood what was going on.
If you have a visual, we'd love if you would send it to us because we can include that in our post. On it, which would be really
cool. Yeah, I can do that.
And in the paper, you mentioned that you needed it to go no further than I think like 10 centimeters because you weren't like picking up these sharks and measuring how far in it was going. How did you figure out that it was not going further than that?
Yeah, so we actually designed that depth based off of our dissections. So for myself and Nick, we were only comfortable tagging sharks that were of the length that we dissected. So we knew where all kind of the important things were in the shark and we didn't want to impact it in any way. And with our tagging pole, we actually designed a stopper so it could only go a certain depth into the musculature. So that's how we stopped that.
I have a quick question going back to your tag package, because I think it's interesting. Like, I don't think a lot of people realize that the scientists actually have to like put some of those things together.
Yeah.
So I have two questions. One being like, what of that package was pre-made that you like ordered and what did you completely fabricate? And the second question being, how does you mentioned that the anchor line like dissolves at the given time and then it like pops up to the surface. How does that work? How does that anchor line get dissolved? And then does the titanium anchor just like stay in the shark afterwards?
Yeah, sure. So I worked actually with the guys from Manx Basking Shark Watch, and one of them is an engineer, helpfully. We worked alongside Jackie and Graham to design the whole thing. But again, because it was during a pandemic, I was literally making the buoyancy packages in my living room. So on my coffee table, sawing stuff and like trying to get flotation right for that buoyancy package to hold all of our devices.
Fabricated the whole thing.
Yeah, literally in my living room, and I had to then learn how to put together like proper crimps, and then I used double barreled crimps, but I only crimped one side so I could thread that thermistor through the other side. So I was really learning so many different skills on the fly, as I said, by myself in my living room trying to make these packages ready to go make my basking shark grab bag that included those devices. But yeah, it's all very much a make what you can out of what we're given. And yeah, we actually modified the titanium anchors as well. So they come with like two bends at either end. But what we did was we had to make those bends like a little bit better, so it would lock into the musculature. We also filed down any sharp edges. And because our flexible stalk was threaded through a hole in the anchor, we also had to make sure those were nice and smooth to not break the thermistor as well. So there were like loads of different tiny modifications going on throughout the whole of the package. I've forgotten your other question. Sorry.
My other question was, how does the anchor line dissolve so that the package releases?
Oh, yeah. So yeah, we use it's called a galvanic timed release, and it's basically two eyelets, so like screw eyelets on either end, and then it's surrounded by this galvanized metal which will dissolve in seawater. And because we didn't know if these packages were going to work, I actually dissolved down some of these links in a bucket before we went out. So you normally get them from like a day to 2 days, 3 days, or however long you want that link to last for. And then during the deployment, that just kind of dissolves, and then you're just left with two eyelets. So that's the thing that breaks, and that's how we get the package back.
Amazing. There's just like so much that goes into this that you don't think about until you have to do it.
No, exactly. It all felt that the whole project felt very much like bucket science to me, as in like just trying to. Yeah, I mean, I'm lucky that in like my personal life, like my hobbies all tend to go towards like crafts or like making stuff. So it was something that I was used to doing. But yeah, using it for a very different method or like purpose.
Insane. So getting into these results, you found that the red muscle extended down the body kind of parallel to the vertebrae. And in my brain, trying to be like descriptive about this for our readers, if you took like a cross section of a shark, the muscle kind of extended out like wings from that vertebrae to that subcutaneous layer, which is the deepest layer of our skin. Is this shape of that muscle unique in sharks or in fish?
Yeah, so in other species of regionally endothermic sharks, so like poor beagle or salmon sharks, that red muscle shape tends to be a lot more cylindrical. And then when we start to look to other species of regionally endothermic fish, like white sharks, it kind of starts to elongate, so it changes shape a little. So again, this could be another interesting study, I think, is looking at this shape of the red muscle throughout lamniforms. But yeah, as whether it's unique or not, I'd say we probably don't know the order well enough in terms of musculature to say that yet. But certainly all the regionally endothermic fish have more red muscle at the trunk of the shark as opposed to towards the tail.
And when you say trunk, what part of the shark do you mean?
Yeah, so from anything from like midline of dorsal fin up to where the head starts. That's kind of the trunk of the shark.
Got it. Figured some people might not be familiar with that sort of term referring to bodies.
Yeah.
People are like, there's no trees on sharks.
These aren't elephants either. What are you talking about?
So you had a lot of limitations because you, you know, had to dissect only a few sharks, but it was due to laws that you could only get certain cross sections. Is that right? You couldn't like dissect the whole animal. So how hard was that then to model what you found based off of, you only were able to make, I think, 5 cross sections. Is that right? Could you explain that a little bit and what that did for your modeling purposes?
Yeah, sure. So in an ideal world, you'd take It's normally between like 11 and 13 cross sections. So when I say cross section, what I mean is like if you imagine like a hot dog and you just chop down the middle, you just keep going to produce little rings. That's kind of what I was hoping to do.
I'm not going to tell the basking sharks you called them a hot dog.
whoa, putting words into my mouth there. I didn't say that. Yeah, that's what I wanted to do in an ideal world, was to cross-section them that way. But because of, yeah, either beach laws or logistics, we just weren't able to do that, and battling against tides and everything. So what we did was we took half cross sections. So yeah, that's, if we go back to our hot dog, just like imagine taking like a half of the half. So we've got effectively like a mirror image of that section. And when it came to recreating that in that 3D kind of representation of the shark, we actually worked with an engineer over in Trinity. So Sarah, I feel like I'm going to pronounce her name very badly. Hang on, let me just double check the spelling. So Sarah Battaglioli, and she was able to kind of create this 3D image in CAD software, so engineering software, based off of our cross sections that we were able to show her. So we had cross sections from two specimens, and we were able to show her that, and then she recreated the kind of body morphometrics from stills and video that's just available on the internet, and any measurements that we had as well. So yeah, that's kind of how that 3D recreation came about.
I do a lot of 3D recreation for my research, and I love segmenting. That's what I was doing this morning. I literally got into the lab at like 7:30 and then drove back here to start the podcast, and all I was doing was looking at CT scans and segmenting.
Amazing. Very cool.
It's really fun, and I feel like people don't, you don't really know how much work goes into creating like a 3D model like that until you do it. Yeah. And when I learned how to do it, I was like, I was vastly underestimating the amount of effort needed.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. And like, we kept on going back to poor Sarah being like, oh, can you just adjust that first orso fin? Just like, it doesn't, no, like, it just doesn't look quite right. And like, yeah, there's, and like, yeah, looking at all the mesh kind of frameworks and hats off. I don't know, it takes some patience to do.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
So moving on to this biologging data, your data show that the white muscle in all four of the tagged individuals was consistently 1 to 1.5 degrees Celsius higher than the surrounding water temp, which was really cool. Is there a scientifically accepted number that the internal body temp has to be above the ambient water temp to be considered a regional endotherm? Or is it kind of just like we're all just playing around in the dark trying to figure out what we accept?
If we go back to, I really shouldn't use that phrase, like old school physiological papers, they had this figure of 2.7 degrees warmer. I'm not sure. I think I lean more towards we're stabbing around in a dark for a temperature elevation, like magic number. I think we're now in a position, thanks to biologging and like more incidences of coming across freshly stranded specimens, that we can kind of put that more into a context of a fish living its free swimming life, and yeah, whether its temperature is going to vary by a lot or like smaller amounts. I would say that the temperature elevation that we see within those first few centimeters of the white muscles in basking sharks is pretty much identical to what we see in regionally endothermic species at that depth, like short fin mako sharks. So it's very comparable temperature elevations within those first few centimeters of the white muscle. What we don't have from basking sharks, and because our ethics are a lot better now, are temperature gradients. So the warm, or the closer you get to that vertebrae, the warmer the shark is going to be. But we're unlikely to ever know that now with basking sharks, just because, you know, we obviously don't want to push too far into collecting these body temperature data sets from a globally endangered species.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so from this research, you found that the location of the red mussel in the basking sharks was more towards the middle of the body by the vertebra than in ectotherms like a blue shark. So in an ectotherm, is the red mussel located further away from the vertebral column or more along the lateral portion of the body?
Yeah, so in ectothermic fish species, we tend to see that red mussel distributed more laterally, so just underneath that skin layer. And what we weren't able to do in this study, because of like all the beach logistical problems that we had, was to conduct an analysis called proportion of red mussel throughout the whole body. So in all other regionally endothermic shark species, you see more of that red mussel, which is found close to the vertebrae at the trunk of the shark, which is what I was mentioning earlier. Whereas in ectothermic shark species, like a blue shark, the majority of their red mussel is actually found from the first dorsal fin backwards. So yeah, there are real differences in the proportion of red mussel, but the consistent thing at the minute appears to be most of the red mussel found in other regionally endothermic shark species that have had this analysis conducted, is that most of it is found towards the trunk of the shark.
It's so like, I never thought about the distribution of mussel in comparison to like total body length, I guess. I like expected, because obviously yeah. I've seen sharks like cut in half. Like I just expected that there was red mussel like going all the way up to the front of their face basically, and then ran all the way back. So it was very interesting to learn that in the paper, that that's not actually normally what is happening with that red mussel.
Yeah.
So in sharks such as a white shark, they have something called heat exchanging reet. What is that? And do we know if basking sharks have that or something similar to that?
Yeah, so the reet system is basically a countercurrent heat exchanger. So that is the magical thing that enables regional endotherms to retain that heat. What it is basically like the meeting of capillaries that are filled with cold blood and those which are filled with warm blood, and then when they come together, they're exchanging heat, oxygen, kind of all those different things that go on in vasculature kind of exchanges. So that's what the reet is. So it's just retaining that heat. As far as whether basking sharks have it, we don't know. So although these were what we've called fresh strandings, they're still strandings, so they're still undergoing tissue degradation, and we weren't able to get tissue samples of a good enough quality to actually go through histology and assess for those reet structures. So in other species where they've done it, in other regional endotherms, they've looked at the reet structures, and it's just basically how many layers of those capillaries are stacked on top of each other. So, and that ranges from anywhere between, I think the least amount of reet seen in a laminiform species is from a longfin mako shark, and they have about 6 of those capillaries stacked on top of each other. Whereas say something like a white shark has about 20 to 30 stacked on top.
Wow. Okay. That varies so much.
Yeah.
You also found that basking sharks have well-developed compact myocardiums. What is a myocardium, and why is finding this significant?
Yeah, so a compact myocardium is just compact tissue in a ventricle of the heart. So in these species, they'll have compact tissue, which is very dense, kind of when you feel it, or they have spongy tissue, which is more spongy. And this actually varies quite a lot in fish species in general. So the majority of fish species will have no compact myocardium at all. So around 80% of fish species will have none of it. But those that do have it typically have a lot less when we're talking about shark species. So for example, the whale shark, so the biggest living species of shark, has about 3% compact myocardium, and that is also a cold-blooded shark. Whereas these regionally endothermic sharks that we know of to date all have a higher percentage of compact myocardium of the heart, so around 30 to 40%. And that is thought to facilitate that blood being pumped around the body to kind of facilitate all of that increase in metabolism. But I should point out that it's not kind of having a high percentage of compact myocardium of the heart does not guarantee that a fish species will be a regional endotherm. So there are other species that have a high percentage of compact myocardium of the heart, but they're ectothermic, like the common carp, which is a freshwater species, has a high percentage of compact myocardium in the heart, that, as far as we know, is an ectotherm. But in shark species, when we use the fact that they might have a high percentage of compact myocardium, along with other features that we've identified, then you could argue that there's more of a case just for using the percentage of compact myocardium of the heart. So I feel like I've used that phrase so many times within those sentences, it's just lost all meaning. But
no, that was amazing.
Yeah.
And actually you brought something up that I thought was super, super interesting. And, you know, obviously whale sharks and basking sharks are like in two different families, but like the fact that they're both these large filter feeding sharks and their physiology is so different, I found really interesting. Yeah. Also because, I mean, wouldn't you say whale sharks are just as migratory as basking sharks? Or do we even know that?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, to be honest, I'm not an expert in whale shark ecology, biology, so I couldn't say, but it is like, yeah, it's interesting, especially, so there's another publication coming out soon, which might address some of these questions.
Exciting.
We'll just have to have you back on.
Exactly. Or I can talk more about it.
This is what we call publication thirst trap.
Oh, I'm such a natural. I didn't know.
Oh my gosh, amazing. So to kind of close out on these results, based on your findings, you argue that basking sharks should not be considered fully ectothermic as they had previously been, and could instead be classified as regionally endothermic shark based on three key traits, which is that they have red muscle found medially to the trunk, thick-walled ventricles, and elevated subcutaneous body temperatures. What do you think are some arguments against them being classified as a regional endotherm?
Yeah, great question. So within fish physiology, there are loads of terms for regional endothermy, loads of terms for ectothermy, just loads of different definitions for different things. And I would argue, fish physiologists, like pure fish physiologists, would say, we don't know that their red muscle is warm. We only know that their white muscle is warm. So in order for the white muscle to be warm, it kind of goes against logic that their red muscle is going to be cold. So that heat generation is coming from one place, which in all shark species we know of so far who are regionally endothermic, most of that heat from muscle is coming from red muscle, and that's being conducted to the white muscle. So without direct red muscle temperature estimates, I'd say that's where the problem is coming from in saying, yes, they're 100% regional endotherms. And we don't have temperature measurements from like brain, eyes, stomach.
One day.
Just
need more engineers to get in this like shark business situation.
Yeah, exactly.
This paper was awesome. I'm just starting to get into physiology for my own work, and I just love seeing how other people tackle it. Is there anything about this paper that we didn't discuss that we should definitely touch on?
Ooh. try and think. I think like one of the coolest things to come out of this as well is that, as I said, this is a species where we don't normally get a very long time to be in and around it. Whereas now, like, we've got this method where we can literally deploy everything and get it back within a second, like when we're up near it. So I think one of the coolest, like, although this isn't like directly related to physiology, or is it, which I'll get off to, but you're reducing that stress that fish is encountering, because you're a scientist, we're only in and around it for a second, we're not bringing it out of the water, we're not fishing for it. So I think that this has some real like outputs in terms of fish welfare. And I say you won't see it physiologically speaking, but we might do. So because you're reducing that stress in terms of attaching a biologger, we might see less effects in terms of how that affects the fish after you let them go. So for example, in like shark species, tuna species, we know that there are different handling techniques which stress out the fish more. And then you tend to see higher tail beat frequencies for hours after they've been released. So I think that there's real implications for the fish that we're tagging to come out of this work as well, which I think is really cool. So
yeah, that is super cool.
Yeah.
And for the end of this, before we ask about your favorite field story, how hard was it to keep this a secret when you realized what you were looking at?
Oh my
at?
God, so hard. It was so difficult. The first things we saw were, we worked with some great colleagues based at the Zoological Society of London. So they run a program called CSIP, which is a cetacean stranding investigation program. And when the first basking shark washed up, I said to Rob, who like heads it, who like runs part of it, please can you try and get some transverse sections, and we had no idea what we were going to see. And I remember Rob sent me the first photos, like I was on holiday as well, so like when I first saw them, I was like, oh my god, they actually have like red mussel, which is closer to the vertebrae than anyone had said. It was so exciting. So that was the start of it. And then we kept on getting more and more bits of information. Like we had another shark that washed up in Cornwall. Again, that was, I was actually in England at the time, so I got to go down and do the dissection, and like to see that up close and personal. So I left like 11 of these like weird cross sections in this shark that members of the public could go and look at as well. And this was during lockdown. And but what happened after I left the shark was that all got posted on social media, being like, oh wait, it's been hit by a speedboat, look at all the propeller marks, and it was me. But I could never say. And then some more washed up in Ireland, and then we got the heart, so we knew how much compact myocardium they had. And then we deployed the temperature tags. We didn't know if it was going to work. It's the first time that it's been done on this species. And then when we got the temperature sensors back, we were literally downloading the data on the boat to try and look at it. And then again, once we saw that consistent temperature elevation, we were like, oh my god, like they've got all these traits and we can't say anything. It's been a real long journey. I think it took us about 2.5 years to get this out there. So it was very difficult to keep a hold of the secret. So the first time I presented it at Sharks International was the first time I really spoke about it, and it was so amazing to kind of let go of that secret.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. And like celebrate that discovery too.
Yeah.
I feel like this is how science is addicting, you know? It's just like,
yeah, totally. Yeah.
You get to know something that others don't yet.
Yeah. I know something you don't know, like that childhood kind of song.
Well, I feel like that was kind of a bonus field story, but we are now at the part of our episode where we ask you, do you have a favorite field story outside of what you've already told us?
Yeah. Try and think. I think one of the best things that will stay with me for my entire life is I was deploying these tags out with Irish Whale and Dolphin Group, and it was in September, and that's when basking sharks would tend to aggregate off the Irish coast, and they perform these amazing behaviours called torusses, which is where they're swimming around in circles. So you get hundreds, thousands of these like 10 metre long basking sharks all swimming around each other. So you see them at the surface, but then there's hundreds underneath. They're literally everywhere. And I got in because I wanted to see where my temperature probe went in. And yeah, it was just the most incredible experience. It was just like being in a wildlife documentary. Like there were just basking sharks everywhere. They appeared out of everywhere. They were all kind of, it was so bizarre to see them like swimming around in their hundreds with their mouths closed. I'm so used to seeing them feeding all the time. And when they've got their mouths closed, their profile changes completely. And it just, they look very like white sharks. Like they're just, yeah, all of these sharks swimming round and round. And yeah, it will stay with me for a lifetime. It was an incredible experience.
That sounds incredible. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It was like being in an episode of Blue Planet. Like it was mad.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, it's amazing. Well, thank you so much for sharing everything that you've learned. This is such a cool episode, and I hope that our listeners enjoy it as much as I did. Where can our listeners follow you and follow more of your work?
Yeah, I'm at Hayley Dalton on Twitter and Instagram. That's pretty much where I am. Or email me on Trinity. If you Google me in Trinity College, then we'll be there.
Awesome.
Cool.
Thank you so much, Dr. Dalton. We really appreciate your time, and we had an awesome time learning. Until next time,
swim you later.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Laughing because my dog is jumping.
I was trying to keep poker face.
I'm really bad at containing my emotions in my face.
I have the weirdest dog.
The cutest dog. Trying to say hello.
Lottie, you have to say hi now.
Lottie's like, I'm not jumping if you're watching.
Okay, the spotlight's on her. Restart that question.